Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Supreme Court's oral arguments over whether an Idaho abortion ban will gut the Reagan-era law EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, which prevents hospitals from denying patients care who show up at hospital emergency rooms. Joining us is Dr. Rob Davidson, a rural West Michigan emergency medicine physician and the executive director of the Committee to Protect Healthcare, a national healthcare advocacy organization made up of thousands of doctors across the country fighting for access to care for their patients and holding politicians accountable. We will discuss his op-ed at The Huffington Post. I'm an emergency physician. Here's how dangerous the Supreme Court abortion ruling could be. Then, with President Biden signing the $61 billion aid package to Ukraine into law, we'll assess how much it will stave off defeat rather than achieve victory for Ukraine, and whether there are any openings for a diplomatic settlement, and speak with George Beebe, the Director of Grand Strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He served in government for nearly 25 years, including as Director of Russia Analysis at the CIA and as a White House advisor on Russia matters for Vice President Dick Cheney. His latest book is The Russia Trap: How Our Shadow War with Russia Could Spiral into Nuclear Catastrophe. Then finally, we'll look into the extent to which minority rule is a structural affliction undermining U.S. democracy and how it is getting worse as Trump's Republican Party makes it clear that they would rather cheat than compete in elections. Joining us is Ari Berman, the national voting right correspondent for Mother Jones and a reporting fellow at Type Media Center. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And his latest book, just out, is Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now, Dr. Rob Davidson, a rural West Michigan emergency medicine physician and the executive director of the Committee to Protect Healthcare, a national healthcare advocacy organization made up of thousands of doctors across the country fighting for access to care for their patients and holding politicians accountable. And he has an op-ed at the Huffington Post, "I am an emergency physician. Here's how dangerous this Supreme Court abortion ruling could be." Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Rob Davidson.
Thank you, Ian.
And of course, the Supreme Court ruling you're talking about is what was discussed in oral arguments today before the Supreme Court, where it seems that an Idaho abortion ban could undermine, if not gut, the Reagan-era law EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, which prevents hospitals from denying patients care who show up at hospital emergency rooms. So is that what's at stake, Rob?
That is absolutely what's at stake. For someone like myself, I've been doing this 25 years, and EMTALA has been part of my practice that whole time. It came about in 1986. And it's the concept of we treat anyone, anywhere, anytime. And Supreme Court possibly may be making that point moot if you happen to be in a state with an abortion ban and the treatment needed includes an abortion.
So just tell us what the world was like before EMTALA.
Again, a little bit before my time, but if we think back, it wasn't very much before I started in medicine. Pre-1986, private hospitals, or really any hospital for any reason, didn't have to take care of a patient if they presented to their department. They were allowed to ask people about their insurance status, and if they determined they couldn't pay or for any other reason, they could discriminate against anyone. And there was no overarching law that prevented that. You know, certainly a code of medical ethics, one would hope, would disallow that in most cases, but there were some cases of folks, Chicago was one place of note, other cities this happened as well, where private hospitals turned away trauma victims in particular, and they ended up dying on their way or at the steps of the public or county hospital where they were directed.
So how does this relate then to the Idaho abortion ban? Because it would seem that what's at issue here is that EMTALA should override any abortion ban if a patient comes in extreme distress that requires an emergency abortion.
One would think, you know, the idea of supremacy would suggest that federal law should do this. And in fact, the Biden administration, that's what they are saying here, right? That's what the U.S. government is saying, that EMTALA law should supersede these state laws. And that's what we're asking for clarity from the Supreme Court. I worry from their overturning of Roe v. Wade, you know, their decision in Dobbs a couple of years ago, that they perhaps don't care about pregnant women in distress and what might happen to them if they don't get the care they need.
But didn't the architect of the Idaho law say exactly that? That the life of the mother is not as important as the life of the fetus?
I believe so. You know, they're trying to protect an unborn individual, and they're willing to sacrifice the person who we might see in front of us. And these are even in cases, I mean, an abortion really may be necessary in cases of severe preeclampsia or eclampsia. That's a condition where a pregnant woman develops severe hypertension and may start having seizures. And in some cases, delivery of that fetus may be the only path to saving the life of that pregnant woman. In some cases, that's pre-viability. That may be at 21 weeks, 22 weeks, 20 weeks. That would be considered an abortion. And in Idaho, you know, the architect and the folks that signed in that legislation and potentially the Supreme Court would say, we're willing to sacrifice that person's life. And unfortunately, what they end up doing is sacrificing the life of the pregnant woman as well as the life of that, you know, potential child or that fetus.
So surely, Rob, it's not unusual for pregnant women to show up at emergency rooms, right? I mean, it's not an exact science when you're going to deliver, right?
So absolutely. But we see many pregnant women in the first trimester. I've seen many in my career that come in the midst of a miscarriage, an incomplete miscarriage, someone who is actively miscarrying, their pregnancy hormone levels are dropping, they're bleeding profusely, they're in severe pain, and they need either a procedure or a medication to help facilitate that miscarriage. Now, in some states where these bans exist, that may be considered an abortion in some cases. If there's still a faint heartbeat that is not viable, and again, every indicator says this is a miscarriage that's inevitable, they're willing to say, and this is why, frankly, the exceptions for, you know, life or health or whatever don't really mean anything, because who is to say when that life is in danger? Is it when their blood count is half normal? Is it when their blood pressure is half normal? Do we have to wait until they're basically dead until we can perform that procedure and then try to bring back that woman? It doesn't work in the real world. There is no black and white of your life is in danger, it is not in danger. So even with these exceptions, they don't help these women. They just make it more murky and put doctors at risk of getting prosecuted just for doing their jobs.
So, Rob, was there anybody speaking at the Supreme Court? I know mostly it was a Solicitor General, but is there any expertise reaching these conservative Supreme Court justices who may well rule based upon zealotry in regard to their anti-abortion dogma as opposed to science and reason? And are you satisfied that anybody made the kind of arguments that you're making here?
I'm unaware of any expert discussion before the court. I actually worked all day today. So I was in the ER taking care of patients on a busy shift. I'm unaware of that. My concern is, you know, even if they apply strict legal principles where they decide based on their interpretation of the Constitution or of you know, basic case law, that this may be legally what they believe to be so, without experiencing the reality of of pregnant women in extremis or in distress, or the reality of myself and my colleagues who are down in the trenches taking care of patients, they can't quite understand what actually happens at that point of care. It's really tragic that their preconceived beliefs about abortion and what they believe that to be and what they believe is right may just make our lives more challenging and the lives of women somewhat expendable in their eyes.
But if you're in one of the 11 states like Idaho, and you did what you think is necessary and right to save the life of the mother, you could go to jail, right?
Absolutely, because even with the exceptions, after the fact, that then comes down to a prosecutor, right? A state attorney general or a local prosecutor to decide, were you in fact, you know, was that woman's life truly in danger? Even in a place that just has an exception for life of the mother or health of the mother, they can, after the fact, decide, well, they weren't quite to the point where we think their health or their life was truly in danger. Therefore, you committed murder. Therefore, we're going to put you in jail. I can't fathom what it must be like. I don't practice in a place. I actually practice in Michigan. We have protections. We put those in place on a ballot initiative in 2022. We worked hard to do that. I would never work in a state that had abortion bans. Should this come to pass where they overrule EMTALA in these cases. And I think, frankly, we've seen a flight of OBGYNs in places like Idaho and other places with extreme bans. I think you're going to see an absolute exodus of emergency physicians in these places already. Frankly, places that can't afford to lose doctors, they're already struggling because they're more rural. They already have a crisis of care and a crisis of coverage with emergency departments, and it's only going to make it worse.
So in other words, if you were in one of these states like Idaho, you would literally have to, you've got the patient on the table or on the gurney, and you would have to just let the patient die, which goes against everything that your Hippocratic Oath and everything that you've trained and your entire professional career for.
I mean, it's truly unthinkable. You can't imagine that being a reality. And again, with exceptions, because that's what they'll cite. Well, we allow you to do this if you're trying to save their life. Well, again, when does that happen? I had a colleague who was an OB said, how much blood has to pour onto the floor, right? What does their blood pressure have to be? It's all ambiguous. They leave it ambiguous on purpose. They want to cloud this. They want to make it as absolute as they can while appearing to show compassion with exceptions for basic, health or life. It just, nothing is that black and white. If you've done medicine long enough, you understand that the vast majority of the decisions that are made and the care that is delivered is in a big gray area. Black and white is pretty uncommon.
But isn't there more at stake than the abortion issue that we're talking about? In other words, if the Supreme Court guts EMTALA, does that mean that you go back to pre-1986? Where there's no guarantee that you'll get treated at an emergency room, and if you don't have the money or you can't produce the right documentation for insurance, then they stick you in another ambulance or whatever, and you go off to county hospital and hopefully don't die on the way.
That's the fear, and that is not hyperbole to think that could happen. The other fear is, you think about in states with, overzealous legislatures who are anti-immigration or anti-individuals who are not documented. We currently have a duty to treat every patient. We don't ask their citizenship. We can't. Well, how is this going to stop the attorney general in Texas from deciding, you have to be a citizen to get emergency care. And so now hospitals are expected to turn away people in their state if they don't have the proper documentation. I think it's not even a slippery slope, because that would suggest that, there's some degree of hyperbole in all of these fears. I think it's right there in front of us. I think this opens the floodgates for what, potentially, again, legislatures, attorneys general, governors, insurance companies, anyone who is a payer who has to pay these bills could try to get through to say, well, this is another case where we don't have to listen to EMTALA, because apparently EMTALA isn't the law of the land. The Supreme Court told us that. It's really terrifying.
Well, since you were busy today, Rob, in the emergency room, what appeared to happen on the Supreme Court, and again, you sort of reading the tea leaves, because you can only go by the kind of questions and the attitudes that came from the justices, but it certainly appears, obviously you have to assume that Alito and Clarence Thomas, the hard right justices, will go along with undermining EMTALA and supporting the Idaho ban. It's pretty clear from questions also that Kavanaugh was also on side of the Idaho ban, and regardless of its implications for EMTALA. And certainly Gorsuch, who even coached the lawyer for Idaho, there's a possibility that Roberts was skeptical, and also Amy Coney Barrett. So this could be incredibly close, and certainly too close for comfort.
Yeah, I mean, this to me, to rational people, to my friends, I've got this op-ed published, I've had friends reach out, you know, who are fellow emergency physicians really around the country, you know, kind of saying thank you for putting to ink what we all have been thinking. Frankly, people who are socially conservative, right? People who have in the past, maybe even in the future, voted Republican, looking at this and thinking, how is this rational? How is a bill that, frankly, you know, Ronald Reagan signed into place? I mean, this is a Reagan law that they're trying to overturn. None of us can believe it actually could happen. It kind of snuck up on us how quickly this all came about, and I think we'll hear about it in a few months. And it really has the ability to change the entire face of how we provide emergency care in this country. I don't think the country is ready for that, and I don't think these justices quite know what that could mean. And I don't think they're going to really appreciate that kind of emergency care that this could usher in. Again, it's terrifying.
But it seems to be based on ideology, right, on this anti-abortion zealotry, because as far as I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, Rob, hospitals obviously probably would like EMTALA overturned because it costs them money. They're not lobbying to overturn EMTALA, are they? It's just up to the Supreme Court, and they've decided to take up this case.
Yeah, and again, I wouldn't even go so far as say hospitals would hope to have it overturned. EMTALA can be a challenge at times. There are sticky situations where you're trying to do what's best for patients when it comes to transfers or diverting people from a low resource place. I work in a small rural hospital. There are patients who, frankly, should be at a larger hospital because of the care they can get. And there are times that ambulances bypass where we are. They call and ask our opinion. And those can, you know, we have to consider EMTALA in all of those cases. But I can't think of one individual at my hospital, certainly from the top down, who doesn't appreciate that we get to be there. It's a privilege to be there for the members of our community, whether they have insurance, whether they can pay out of pocket, or whether they have no ability to pay. If they're having an emergency, we're glad to be there. That's our job. That's our role in this community. I think this is particularly important in small communities where, you know, the hospitals, a lot of people work there. We know everybody. These are our actual neighbors and friends, people I've been working in the same hospital for 22 years. These are people I've seen, their family members. I take care of staff's family members. You know, you really care about these people. You would never want something bad to happen to them. And if you live in a place with these extreme bans, that's exactly what the court's telling you should do.
Well, Dr. Rob Davison, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Rob Davidson, who's a rural West Michigan emergency medicine physician and the executive director of the Committee to Protect Healthcare, a national healthcare advocacy organization made up of thousands of doctors across the country fighting for access to care for their patients and holding politicians accountable. He has an op-ed at the Huffington Post. I'm an emergency physician. Here's how dangerous this Supreme Court abortion ruling could be. We can take a brief station break and be back discussing President Biden's signing of the $61 billion aid package for Ukraine into law and assess how much it will stave off defeat rather than achieve victory for Ukraine and whether there are any openings for a diplomatic settlement.
Doctor, my eyes have have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without pride. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is George Beebe, the Director of Grand Strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He served in government for nearly 25 years, including as Director of Russia Analysis at the CIA and as White House Advisor on Russia Matters for Vice President Dick Cheney. His latest book is The Russia Trap: How Our Shadow War with Russia Could Spiral into Nuclear Catastrophe. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Beebe.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us, George. And President Biden signed the $61 billion aid package to Ukraine, and he promised that weapons would be on the way very soon. And as you have pointed out, most of that $61 billion goes to replenish U.S. stocks, some of which I believe are in Europe. They've been pretty heavily depleted, haven't they? And not to mention the number of Patriot batteries that were used to defend Israel recently. So what's left in the pipeline? Have the NATO countries, and particularly the Baltic countries, really depleted their stocks? And what's the readiness situation with NATO and the United States as a result?
Well, I think we're in a precarious situation. We took a lot of inventory off the shelf in the first couple of years of after Russia's invasion to provide to the Ukrainians, and most of that is gone. It's been used or destroyed, and we don't have a whole lot left. So it's not as if Congress says, okay, you know, here's some money, send a bunch of stuff to Ukraine, and it arrives next week or next month. A lot of this is going to have to be manufactured. That's going to take time. The U.S. doesn't have a lot of capacity to ramp up its military manufacturing very greatly or very quickly. There are real limits on our capacity here. So this new aid package will help to some degree. I think it will help to minimize the likelihood that the Russians are going to break through Ukrainian lines next week or next month. But it is at best something that is a holding action. It's not going to bridge the very wide gap between the amount of artillery shells the Ukrainians can fire in this war. It's not going to provide the kind of air defense capability that Ukraine needs to defend itself against Russian attacks, including from glide bombs that they've been using very effectively in great numbers recently. And it can't make up for the enormous manpower disparity between Ukraine and Russia. The Ukrainians have one of the lowest birth rates in the world right now. They've lost millions of people fleeing the war. And they are really scraping the bottom of the barrel and trying to get people onto the front lines to fight. So this is quite a precarious situation all around for everybody involved on the West in Ukraine.
Well, apparently there's only one U.S. factory that produces the 155-millimeter shells. And I believe the other, I think it's 120-millimeter Soviet bloc ammunition, has pretty much run out from the former Soviet Warsaw Pact states that have been helping out Ukraine. The glide bombs, as you mentioned, apparently are quite devastating. I don't know whether the F-16s, when they arrive, will do much. They're actually pretty vulnerable, aren't they, F-16s? I mean, there's a sense that that's kind of like a miracle weapon or a miracle cure, I should say. I'm not sure about that. What about you, George?
Well, F-16s are not going to shoot down glide bombs. Number one. Number two, the numbers of F-16s that we're talking about providing to Ukraine are nowhere near what would be required to really contend with the superior numbers that the Russians have. The Russians have over 1,000 aircraft in their inventory. The Ukrainians have somewhere over 100 aircraft in their inventory. putting, you know, a couple of dozen F-16s on Ukrainian territory is not going to do a lot to change that. Moreover, it's not an aircraft that's particularly well suited to the conditions that Ukraine is going to be fighting under. It's a single aircraft fighter. It requires more or less a pristine airstrip to take off and land from. If it gets debris in that engine, it basically is, you know, rendered inoperable for some time until it can be repaired. And a lot of the Ukrainian airfields are Soviet-era airfields. They're not in particularly good shape and just not a good fit for what the F-16 requires. So will the F-16 help? Yes, a little bit. Is it really going to change the course of the battle in any kind of significant way? I think the answer is no, it won't.
So is the situation then that this aid package will stave off defeat, but not in any way move Ukraine towards any kind of victory?
I think it buys time, and I think it's aimed at buying time. I think the hope in Washington is that if you can keep the Russians from overwhelming Ukraine this year, then the math starts to work out better for us in 2025 and 2026. We will be able to ramp up our artillery shell production, our production of Patriot missiles, et cetera. And then, you know, Ukraine might be in a position where it could take another run at the Russians with some new offensive in a year or two. But I think that's a very risky strategy and quite optimistic because Ukraine's manpower numbers are looking so dire right now. And there's really not a whole lot that the Ukrainians can do to change that. They are reducing the age at which they can draft people in the military, yes, but that is not without its social and political consequences. That is in part why Ukraine has been so reluctant to look to drafting younger men into the military. They're also doing things like refusing consular services for Ukrainian men of fighting age who have left Ukraine and are now in Europe. But I think that speaks to just how desperate the Ukrainian manpower situation is becoming. And no aid package from the West is going to change that. The only thing that would really change that, it would be if the United States or NATO were willing to put large numbers of fighting troops on the ground in Ukraine. And fortunately, that's something we've said we would rule out because of the dangers of escalation that that would entail.
Right, but President Macron of France has suggested that that might be necessary.
He has. And I think, again, that speaks to the growing pessimism in the West about the momentum in this war. There are growing concerns that the Russians might, in fact, produce a Ukrainian collapse. So people are naturally asking, well, what can we do about it? One of the things that is being discussed openly, as President Macron has said, is the possibility of putting Western forces on the ground. Now, so far, there's been a lot of pushback to that. And my guess is that that was something he said much more for political effect than out of any serious intent to put French forces on Ukraine as part of this war. But, you know, again, the closer either side gets to a real victory, the greater the dangers of escalation from either side become. We saw that earlier in the war when Russia looked like it was losing this war and the possibility of escalation loomed large on Russia's side. Now we're seeing the reverse dynamic with the West.
So at this point, is there any leverage on the part of Ukraine and its backers of NATO and the United States? Obviously, Putin was hoping that this package wouldn't get voted through, and he obviously, there's no mystery that Donald Trump has been resisting or encouraging what's being referred to as the pro-Putin caucus in the House to delay it. But now that it's happened, does it offer any leverage? Because at the end of the day, you, for the longest time, have been calling for some kind of diplomatic strategy, or at least to tie what military strategy there is, although that's not entirely clear, with some kind of diplomatic strategy. So at this point, what leverage does Ukraine and its backers have?
Well, I think we do have leverage, but we have to broaden our apertures in looking at this war and not look at our leverage exclusively through military terms. Right now, the Russians have the upper hand on the battlefield. Where the United States has leverage, I think, is less on the battlefield and more in the broader geopolitical and economic playing field. The Russians can probably achieve much of what they want on the battlefield in Ukraine. They probably can capture the lands that they have claimed but don't yet occupy and control. They probably can wear down Ukraine to the point where it is effectively neutralized as a military fighting force for some years to come. What they can't do is fight their way back into having an accepted role in European security. What they can't do is fight their way back into some sort of detente relationship with the West that reduces their military and economic dependence on China, which has grown quite extreme. And they can't avoid, just by, you know, quote unquote, winning the war in Ukraine, some sort of long-term military standoff with NATO in Europe that will require a much greater degree of militarizing the Russian economy than I think most Russians would like to see. So those are issues on which the West has leverage, should we choose to use it. But the only way you can use it is if you're willing to talk to the Russians. So far, we've been unwilling. So what that means is, you know, we've reduced this war to a military struggle on the battlefield, where Russia has increasing advantages due to its, you know, vastly greater population, its greater military production capability. I don't think that's in our interest. I think we ought to broaden the scope of what we're negotiating over, and in so doing, take advantage of those areas where we have greater leverage over the Russians.
But what is the incentive on Putin's side? It doesn't seem like he has made any indication that he's interested in making a deal. He's been kind of dismissive of Ukraine, and seems to be turning the country into a garrison state, particularly cracking down on any form of dissent. The economy doesn't seem to be hurting too much. In fact, there's been some growth in the Russian economy in spite of the sanctions. He's got India and China buying his oil. What's his incentive? He thinks he's going to win, doesn't he?
Well, the incentive that he has, and I would quibble a little bit with what you said, the Russians, including Putin, have repeatedly said they are open to negotiations, but they don't believe that those negotiations ought to be exclusively bilateral with Ukraine. They regard Ukraine as Washington's proxy, and you don't talk to the proxy, you talk to the person that is behind that calling the shots, and the Russians believe that is Washington. So they are saying they're willing to talk. They are deeply skeptical that we, in turn, are willing to negotiate with them. So long as we ourselves refuse to negotiate, we're not actually calling the Russians bluff, you know, if they are indeed bluffing. I think it's in our interest to say, fine, you want to talk, let's talk. Then we'll get a clearer picture of exactly where they are and exactly what kind of leverage we've got in all of this. But, you know, in terms of military incentives to negotiate, you know, the Russians think momentum's on their side and time is on their side in all of this. But it's those bigger geopolitical and economic issues where Russia does have an incentive to talk. The Russians, I don't think, are particularly happy that they are effectively persona non grata in Europe. The closer they get to a situation where they realize they're not going to lose the war in Ukraine, the greater, I think, the impetus will be on the part of the Russian people to say, okay, let's go back to being a normal country with normal relations with Europe. And, you know, less a garrison state and less isolated in its relationships with China and the global south.
So is there any, it's a bit of a black box figuring out what's going on in the Kremlin, and we just learned today that the deputy defense minister has been arrested for corruption. Is there any sort of breakup with amongst the Siloviki? Are there factions? Are there the internationalists who have to be concerned? You know, you've got now Finland and Sweden joining NATO. It's not looking good. You're going to have an arms race with NATO countries building up their defense inventories, which is what we've been discussing. Right. That's the trajectory we're on, isn't it? So are there those kind of voices within the Kremlin as opposed to the hardline militarists?
Well, you know, I think you're right. It is a bit of a black box, and we just don't know for sure. What I would say is that in the past, there have been factions. There have been those who have argued for a more pragmatic, business-like relationship with the West, as well as the hardliners that believe that there is no deal possible with the United States, and that the United States is simply intent on dealing Russia a strategic defeat that would lead to its departure from the ranks of the world's great powers and ultimately to its physical breakup over time. What I would say, though, is despite that opacity, it is not in the interest of the United States to disempower the pragmatists to the degree that they exist. And right now, refusing to talk and behaving in such a way that actually allows the hardliners to say, you know, hey, we're right. The United States won't talk and is only interested in our complete humiliation and defeat. That's not in our interest. We should adopt a situation where the pragmatists have something to point to that allows them to say, look, we ought to explore the possibilities of diplomacy with the United States. Right now, we're not willing to do that, but I think that needs to change.
Well, George Beebe, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with George Beebe, who's the Director of Grand Strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He served in government for nearly 25 years, including as Director of Russia Analysis at the CIA and as a White House advisor on Russia matters for Vice President Dick Cheney. And his latest book is The Russia Trap, How a Shadow War with Russia Could Spiral into Nuclear Catastrophe. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking to the extent to which minority rule is a structural affliction undermining U.S. democracy and how it is getting worse as Trump's Republican Party makes it clear they would rather cheat than compete in elections. Well, everywhere is war. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ari Berman, the National Voting Rights Correspondent for Mother Jones and a reporting fellow at Type Media Center. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And his latest book just out is Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ari Berman.
Hey, Ian. Good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it does seem that of the two parties that we have, the Republicans have reached a point under the leadership of Donald Trump, the new Republican Party, if you will, that they would rather cheat than compete. I mean, one of the more extraordinary things that's happening now is that the America First Policy Institute, which is Trump's former aides, Miller and others, are suing in Arizona for the right to harass election workers. They're suing to stop a bill that protects election workers from harassment and intimidation and coercion. And they're doing the same in Minnesota. It's pretty brazen, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the stories that I try to tell in the book is just how the radicalization of the Republican Party has deepened over time. I mean, the fact is the Republican Party was radicalizing against democracy before Donald Trump, and they have radicalized against democracy even more under Donald Trump, and particularly since Trump tried to overturn the election and incited the insurrection, which was the most stunning example of how Republicans have attempted to overthrow the will of the majority in recent times. And so I think the Republican Party decided a while ago that they weren't going to be able to be a majority party because their policy positions were too unpopular on things like abortion, on gun control, on voting and other issues. And so they decided they were going to try to rig the political system to entrench their power instead. And they've been remarkably successful in doing that. They've also benefited from a political system that is already rigged in their favor in such a way that it benefits smaller, whiter, more conservative states as opposed to larger, more diverse, more urban states through things like the Electoral College and the U.S. Senate.
But in terms of the thrust of your new book, Ari, that makes the case that the central threat now facing American democracy is minority rule. But we have minority rule in many aspects. First of all, my understanding is that the Democrats, because of gerrymandering, need to get 8% more votes than the Republicans do just to break even or to have a level playing field. So they have that deficit. The Senate is an anti-majoritarian minority rule organ, if you will. The Electoral College, again, is about minority rule. And the Supreme Court is about minority rule. So minority rule is embedded structurally, is it not, in our political life?
Yes, and that's really the key story that I try to tell in the book, is how minority rule has evolved over time. That it was built into the Constitution when they created institutions like the Senate and like the Electoral College that violated basic principles of one person, one vote that were designed to protect an elite white male property holding minority at the expense of the rest of the country. And even as some of those institutions have democratized, in many ways, the inequities in the institutions have gotten worse. So the Electoral College is in many ways more undemocratic than it was before. And the US Senate is more skewed towards smaller, wider, more conservative states than it was decades ago because of population change. So a lot of our institutions have become more undemocratic. And then you layer on top of that the fact that you then have this anti-democratic movement that's doubling down on all of these newer or new forms of anti-democratic tactics. So you have gerrymandering, voter suppression, election subversion, censoring of history, all of that stuff layered on top of an undemocratic political system. And that's a very volatile situation for democracy.
So just to give an idea of what you're talking about here, Ari, you've written that in 1790, the country's largest state, Virginia, had 12 times the population of the smaller state, Delaware. And today, California, the largest state, has 67 times the population of the country's smaller state by population, Wyoming. And that by 2040, roughly 70% of Americans will live in 15 states with 30 senators. That means that 30% of America is going to elect 70 senators. And the Senate, based on how it is set up, guarantees minority rule. So what can be done? Is this inexorable?
Well, I mean, things could be done to try to soften the edges of that. For example, if Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico were added new states, it would make the Senate less biased in favor of wider, more rural states. Now, it would still be biased, but there would be less of a bias. And then it could potentially operate on a more majority rule basis. But yeah, I mean, the Senate is a very skewed institution, and it was skewed from the very beginning. And there were fierce debates about what the Senate should look like. And I trace those debates in my book. And in fact, many of the most prominent founding fathers, people like James Madison, were very unhappy with how the Senate turned out. They wanted the Senate to be an elite body, but they also wanted the Senate to be based on proportional representation. Madison, who represented Virginia, the largest state in the Union, felt like the larger states should have more representatives than the smaller states, because that would give the Senate more legitimacy if it was based on population and proportional representation. But the smaller states basically threatened to leave the Union if they didn't get what they wanted. And Madison warned that it would allow what he called a more trifling minority than ever to control that body. And of course, that's what happened, as the gap between large and small states has grown so much larger than it was in the 1780s. So it's always interesting to me where conservatives go back and they invoke originalism. But if you want to go back and invoke originalism and interpret the Constitution as it was drafted, you also have to wrestle with the fact that some of the founders themselves were really uncomfortable with the institutions they were creating.
So you've written that a lot of people feel like we dodged a bullet in 2020, but the gun is being reloaded right now. And of course, that is frightening in the sense that what we saw in 2020 was comical. It was dangerous, but it was comical with, you know, Rudy Giuliani in front of
the hair dye going down his
the
face.
The hair dye dripping down and the Kraken woman with her insane ramblings, etc. I mean, she had, you know, in the case down in Georgia, she had to recant and apologize. But this time around, they're much cleverer. I mentioned Stephen Miller in terms of overturning or suing for the right to harass election workers in Arizona. They're going to be better this time. They're going to be more organized. Well, they are better this time. They're more organized, more focused, and less crazy. I mean, they're cynical, but not crazy.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, there is an election denier movement in this country that there wasn't in 2020. It was all very much seat of the pants. They didn't know what they were doing. They didn't have great lawyers. They had very weak arguments. And the effort of the Republican Party, I would say the overriding effort of the Republican Party since 2020 has been to try to institutionalize the insurrection through a number of different tactics. First, so many key states have changed their voting laws to make it harder for Democratic constituencies to vote. They don't have to overturn the election on the back end if they can try to rig it on the front end. Then you have all of these new groups, like you mentioned earlier, the Stephen Miller groups and others, funded with a lot of conservative dark money, that are pushing this agenda and are very organized in terms of taking over local Republican parties, taking over local election operations to try to support the election denier movement. And then you also have the fact that you know, Trump himself has raised a lot more attention to these issues. There's going to be 100,000 supposedly poll watchers manning the polls. And so this has really become a core principle of the Republican Party. The Republican Party was devoted to things like voter suppression beforehand, but they're so much more devoted to it now. And then they've layered election subversion onto that. So there's really two threats. There's a threat of, will we have free and fair elections in the first place? And then even if we do have free and fair elections, will the votes be counted if Republicans don't like them? And that movement has gotten a lot more organized since 2020.
So let's talk about this Republican mantra that you often hear from conservative Republicans like Senator Mike Lee and John Eastman, the lawyer that, and Cleta Mitchell, these lawyers that tried to give some justification to Trump's Stop the Steal lie. They keep saying that America is not a democracy, it's a republic. So how do they get away with that? And what are they saying there?
Well, it's something that dates back to the John Birch Society, which was a fiercely anti-communist conservative organization in the 1950s that basically said there was an international communist conspiracy in the U.S. that consisted of Dwight Eisenhower and Earl Warren and the civil rights movement. They were all working together in the service of Soviet Russia. So it was such a fringe organization. It was pushed out of the Republican Party. But basically what they argued was that because the founders were skeptical of direct democracy in places like ancient Greece, therefore the U.S. was not a democracy because the founders didn't like that idea of democracy. What they ignore is that the founding fathers created a representative democracy in which representatives would represent the people, basically. Now, the founders created a very undemocratic representative democracy, but nonetheless, I don't think anyone would argue that we're not a democracy in terms of the fact that we at least have representatives that are now elected by the people. And so what they're doing is they're saying the U.S. isn't a democracy to then ensure that they can get through all these anti-democratic tactics. So it's a very convenient way of rewriting American history to basically say anything anti-democratic we want to do is fine because America was never intended to be a democracy, leaving aside that America was intended to be a representative democracy, however flawed that representative democracy was.
So Ari Berman, you have an article at The Atlantic, The Conservative Who Turned White Anxiety into a Movement, Pat Buchanan Made White Republicans Fear becoming a racial minority, now Donald Trump is reaping the benefits. And Donald Trump met recently at Mar-a-Lago with the new House Speaker, Mike Johnson, and they came up with this notion of election integrity, which is a cover for this minority rule and Stop the Steal lie that's metastasized into a core Republican belief. It's based upon these massive lies that keep persisting, and that is that the Democrats have open borders, lie number one. Lie number two, that they're letting in undocumented people from the South simply to vote Democrat, which is not happening and not possible. And yet people believe it. And it all, in many ways, goes back to what Pat Buchanan wrote in 2011, that either the Republican Party puts an end to mass immigration or mass immigration will put an end to the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, you set that up very well. I mean, what they're trying to do is they're trying to fuse voter suppression with anti-immigrant hysteria so that they both can restrict immigration, but they can also restrict voting rights. And I think what it dates back to is this fear of a majority-minority country and this fear that white people are going to be one day be the minority. And that was voiced most prominently by Pat Buchanan in the 1990s when he ran for president, first in 92 and then in 96. And Buchanan basically was the first major politician in Republican circles to warn about the changing demographics of the country, to say that white people were going to be a minority and that this was going to threaten the Republican Party's hold on power. And so what Buchanan did is he mixed essentially 1960-style racism with a backlash to the civil rights movement with these newer warnings about non-white immigration. And essentially, he made opposition to demographic change the central organizing principle of his candidacy, and that influenced the Republican Party, and it very much influenced Trump, because Buchanan was talking about things like a Buchanan fence, which of course Trump turned into the wall. And Buchanan was talking about things like denying citizenship to children born of undocumented immigrants, and that's another thing that Trump has said in terms of changing the 14th Amendment. So a moratorium on immigration, that's something that Trump has talked about and tried to ban immigration from Muslim countries. So I mean, so much of what Buchanan did in the 90s, which was quite frankly regarded as very fringe, later became something that Donald Trump in his quote-unquote America First platform marketed to a much broader audience and made a central part of his platform.
But the lie inherent in the idea that immigration will put an end to the Republican Party, it's Republicans, it's businessmen, it's factory owners, it's restaurant owners. They want cheap labor. I mean, how can they say that the Democrats want open borders in order to get voters when the reason that the borders they're not open, but one of the main explanations for people crossing the border is that they get work. They can't get work where they live. They come here and they're undocumented, and it's a good deal for American business owners because they don't pay proper wages and they don't pay Social Security. And, you know, it's always been, to my mind, that's what illegal immigration is about. It's in effect benefits Republicans in the sense that the Chamber of Commerce types and even big corporations like meat packing firms, Tyson's, all these, they're full of undocumented workers. So isn't that the hidden truth here?
Yes. I mean, and that's a good point. And of course, Buchanan ran against the Republican establishment and basically, in kind of echoing Trumpian terms, accused them of being globalists who were trying to import cheap labor. So Buchanan went after the Republican establishment on that issue. But the other thing is that there's no inherent reason why mass immigration, even if we had mass immigration, which we don't, would put an end to the Republican Party, because the Republican Party at various times has done very well with these constituencies. George W. Bush, for example, got 40%. Of the Latino vote. There's nothing inherent that the GOP can't do well with these constituencies. It's just that they've stopped making the argument to them. And I think that's the broader point about their push for minority rule, is instead of trying to actually persuade people to back their policies or trying to moderate their policies. They're always trying to rig the political system in such a way that prevents people that disagree with them from having the same kind of say in the political process. And I think Buchanan was really open in saying that Republicans had to take more extreme measures to be able to stop the changing demographics of America. And I think that argument really took on a lot of urgency for Republicans after the election of Barack Obama, because they saw the first Black president elected by this very diverse coalition. And they realized, oh man, if this is going to be the future of the country, then we have to do something about it. And we're not going to be able to change our policies, so let's try to change the political system to prevent that coalition from becoming the new normal in American politics.
So rather than embrace multiculturalism and diversity, Trump is demonizing minorities. I mean, what's the logic there?
That's right. And I mean, that's what Buchanan said, is that, you know, the more multicultural, the more diverse, the more globalized America becomes, the more democratic it's going to become. And he meant big D democratic, but I think in some ways he was also worried about small D democracy, that if democracy became more responsive to becoming a multiracial democracy, then that would hurt what Buchanan called the emerging white minority. So there's, Trump has this idea that, you know, democracy is only good if it benefits him and his supporters. Well, that's not actually democracy. That's autocracy. And I think you increasingly see the Republican Party going in these anti-democratic direction because they're worried that the country is slipping away from them and they have to essentially create a fortress to stop what they view as the coming siege.
So just in closing though, Ari, you mentioned that back in 2000, there was a primary race between Buchanan and, of all people, Donald Trump for the Reform Party in the 2000 primary, in which Trump attacked Pat Buchanan by saying, quote, "Look, he's a Hitler lover. I guess he's an anti-Semite. He doesn't like the blacks. He doesn't like the gays. It's just incredible that anybody could embrace this guy." Today, that sounds like Donald Trump talking about himself.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And that's the fascinating story I tell in the book. And this is just what I talk about when I say the radicalization of the Republican Party. I mean, you have in 1999, Trump criticizing Buchanan for being a racist and a bigot and all of this. And then basically 6 years later, Trump becomes Buchanan. And he calls Hispanics rapists and murderers. He talks about banning Muslims from the U.S. He demonizes African-Americans. And he realized that the politics of racial resentment is his path to power. Trump realizes that more effectively than Buchanan ever did, and recognizes it more effectively than what Buchanan ever did. And what Buchanan said is that he was going to take the platform of David Duke, who was a Klansman turned Louisiana state representative, and he was going to market it to a much broader audience. Well, that's what Trump did with Buchanan. He takes Buchanan's platform and he markets it to a much broader audience, and he really rides that wave of resentment against the changing demographics of the country into power, and of course benefits from a minority political system, because if it hadn't been for the Electoral College, then Trump would never have been elected in the first place. So Trump's never been able to win a majority of Americans, but he's benefited from the counter-majoritarian structure of American politics.
Well, Ari Berman, I thank you for joining us here today and for your new book.
Thanks so much, Ian. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Ari Berman, the national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones and a reporting fellow at Type Media Center. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And his latest book just out is Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media, And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.